I think we're ready to start. I'm going to unmute the mics.
There we go. And ask Christy and Amy to
take
us into some more conceptual framework.
So this presentation is divided into two sections. I'll start with a discussion about the conceptual framework and how that is dealing with presentation and disclosure. And then in the next half hour, Amy will take over and talk about the disclosure forum and how that activity is contributing to our work on disclosures. So if we look firstly at the agenda paper, it's 4B, which talks about the conceptual framework and how it's dealing with presentation and disclosure. Just in terms of what this presentation is saying and the context in which it's saying is we've only had one discussion with the board so far on both presentation and that disclosure, and that was regarding an analysis of items that we currently present in OCI. The first substantial discussion will be in the March meeting, and the papers are just being posted yesterday. So what we've done here is sort of a high-level review, because at the time that we actually prepared these slides, those papers hadn't been finalised. So just to give you some context of where we're at in these discussions. I think the best place to start is if I go through to slide 4, because I'll talk about presentation overall. And when we talk about presentation, just the key things to bring out of this slide is that when we refer to presentation, what we're going to refer to in the discussion paper is what we describe and what we place on the face of the primary financial statements. There's been some confusion about the use of the term disclosure and presentation, so we felt it would be useful to define presentation as the amounts that we put on the primary financial statements. The other points to bring out of this slide is that we propose to define or to describe the purpose of the primary financial statements, and that will be useful when we talk about what the scope of the disclosures that we will need to make in order to supplement those financial statements. We'll also talk a little bit about some high-level principles on cohesiveness, so bring in some of the discussions that we had in the financial statement presentation project on cohesiveness, and bring in those principles that the board may want to consider to make sure that the financial statements are consistent across themselves, so that they may consider providing categories along the lines of on business activities, financing activities, or tax, so that you've got a way to link through those primary financial statements. And we'll also mention offsetting broadly, in the sense that the presentation of assets and liabilities or income and expense you would expect to be gross on the primary financial statements, unless that doesn't reflect the substance of the transaction, and that's reflecting what's in current standards at the moment. I now want to move on to, I think, maybe the more substantive part of the discussion on presentation, and it's definitely where we've been spending a lot more of our time and the people have been a lot more focused, and that's in how we will present information on the statement of comprehensive income, and in particular how we would reflect profit and loss and other comprehensive income. Now, we've taken the approach in the discussion paper to start with the distinction between profit and loss and OCI. We do explore an alternative, or ask the question whether we should explore an alternative single statement approach, but the primary focus at the moment is being trying to distinguish between the items of what should go in profit and loss and what should go in OCI. We haven't sought to define exactly what financial performance means in terms of whether it relates to a specific total or subtotal. So we haven't said, tried to say that profit and loss is financial performance or represents financial performance. Our view is that all items of income and expense should provide you with some information about financial performance. And the conceptual framework of the discussion paper has tried to articulate how you could aggregate and classify that information to give you the best communication of that financial performance. In terms of, I'm flicking through these slides on page 7, in terms of how we've proposed to do that, we've tried to set out some principles and concepts for distinguishing between profit and loss and OCI. And those principles, high-level principles, are that items presented in profit and loss do communicate the primary picture of the entity's financial performance. We then go on to say that items of income and expense, because of that, should be recognised in profit and loss, unless presenting an item in OCI provides a better depiction of performance. And then finally, that you would expect that if you do present something in OCI, it should be recycled if that recycling provides you with relevant information in that period. So using those principles, we try to think about the situations that they could apply in something that's workable or tangible, and we came up with two concepts. The first, what we call bridging items, so that's where you use OCI as a bridge, so it forms the link between a measurement basis in the statement of financial position, so that may have fair value presented on it. But you think from a performance perspective, the transaction would be better presented on an amortized cost basis. In that situation where you're effectively concurrently having two measurement bases for one asset or one liability, OCI provides that bridge or that link between those two measurement bases. That's one circumstance we think we would use OCI. The second is where what we've called mismatch remeasurements, and that's where you have an item which forms an integral part of an overall economic phenomenon, but the other parts of that phenomenon haven't yet occurred, such that it's sitting alone, so presenting the information about that item of income and expense in that period is not giving you the best information about financial performance because it's not connected to the other relationships. And the best example of that is cash flow hedging, where you may have a transaction which you are expecting to occur in the future, but the hedged item has not yet occurred, so therefore presenting the gain or loss on the derivative hedging that item in the current period is not giving you the best information about performance. It would be, so it's stored in OCI to match the entire transaction. That gives you a sort of a sense, I hope, of what we are proposing in terms of presentation broadly and specifically on profit and loss and OCI. And at this point, I want to ask you the questions about one in particular. Do you agree with that approach? Do you think that the distinction between profit and loss and OCI is useful? And do you have any comments on the approach that we're adopting, or would you distinguish profit and loss and OCI differently from what we are attempting to do?
Peter,
I need to be first on this one. I really like the concept. I definitely think it's useful. And if I look at the companies that I look into, roughly 150 companies, I can see that the other comprehensive income is mostly currency translation on foreign subsidiaries. But that is obvious from a Swedish perspective because of the Swedish krona. But also currency hedging, or hedging in general, but it's mostly currency hedging. And now from this year, we have had some companies showing a pension, the revaluation of the pension liability and assets in other comprehensive income, very useful compared to the corridor method. and also available for sale, but that is normally very small amounts. Those four are what I see normally. If I see something else, I get suspicious. So already today, I think it is a fairly clear definition what should be included and not. And I think it presents the income statement in a way that I agree with. I mean, I have kind of a, not fully, but kind of a transaction-based approach on the top, so to speak. And then I have the revaluations in the bottom. Not fully, because the IAS 40 and 41 is included up there, and that is a problem. But if I see, if I look at the income statements where we cannot use the other comprehensive income, like if you have an interest rate derivative that is not classified as a hedge, so you need to take them into the income statement, I can see that the volatility in the financial net normally is not explained, so it's very difficult to get hold of. If this were, would have been classified as a hedge and transferred over to the income statement, it would have made me more pleased, for instance. And I think the concept definitely can be expanded, but I cannot understand why not all items are recirculated into operating earnings. For instance, now with pensions. And secondly, why isn't it a requirement that you need to show the recirculated amounts in the quarterly reports? Because take currency hedging, for example, that is by far the most important item when it comes to quarterly reports. How much have gone into operating earnings? How much is left? Normally, in 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10 companies, I'm left with a net amount that absolutely don't tell me anything about how the operating earnings figure has been affected. So recirculation and better specification in the quarterly reports. And then I would be pleased if both IAS 40 revaluations and 41 revaluations, which we have a lot in the forest companies, and I can tell you more about that later, would be included in other comprehensive income also.
So would you include all revaluations then that are not trading in nature?
All is easy to say, but then we come to like revaluations on receivables, trade liabilities and stuff like that. And that is kind of a different creature. So in general, yes. But then we come down to the specific details and I can say, well, that should probably be included in operating earnings.
And then to confirm, you'd say recycle everything.
Recycle everything, yes.
When realized, what would be your trigger?
When they are realized.
So for instance, if on
hand. Yeah, but for instance, if you have a translation adjustment in a foreign subsidiary and you sell that foreign subsidiary, that is natural that we recycle that. But it can stay in other comprehensive income accumulated for years. So I don't need to amortize that amount, luckily. But then if we have pensions, it's a different creature. I like a mix of the old corridor method with the new one. So I amortize because I have already a lot of companies that constantly show a negative, never a positive, over several years, a negative item in OCI relating to revaluations on pensions. And to me, it's very good information. Previously, I got it from the annual report once a year and in April. Now I get it constantly. So if I want, it gives me an extra indicator that this is probably a company that shows too small costs, or I can increase the risk premium, or how I deal with it, it's up to you. But I get the information, and on a quarterly basis for most of the companies already. And that is useful information, definitely.
Sue?
Oh, that was quick. I suppose no deep thinking on this as of yet, but I agree on the recycling point. I think these things eventually should come through, and it's probably on realization. Pensions would take quite some time. If you sell an equity security, you know, when you sell it, that's I don't understand on IFRS 9 the distinction in treatments between debt and equity instruments, for example. So I think recycling, I think what you've characterized here is bridging items and mismatch. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably an appropriate characterization of what's already in OCI, because there hasn't been a characterization previously. But then I'm just sort of thinking ahead, and does that then have consequences? Because I sort of see the mismatched remeasurements as a subset of what we're really just trying to do is get the debits and the credits to add up. And if it hasn't gone through income state, gone through net income, it has to pop out in OCI. And could it be that by setting up two sort of distinct categories, you know, they're equivalent to the bullet points here. I don't know if they're equivalents in terms of the thinking, but does that have further consequences? Do we need to then think, is this a mismatched remeasurement, or is this a bridging item, and will there be consequences for that classification?
One thing we did feel was useful with the different classifications was there was a sense that the mismatched remeasurements had less relevant information in the period until there was, they matched the related transactions. Whereas with a bridging item, there is a sense that it's providing you perhaps equal or, more equal but different information. So there may be a different weighting between the two. But I do understand your point that ultimately they are a bridge between, for a mismatch remeasurement, perhaps it's that there's no other item sitting on the statement of financial position, whereas for a bridging item, then you are clearly having two measurement bases, whereas for a mismatch, you may not even recognise the unmatched item.
And a different way for me of thinking about it is that a mismatched item is actually fixing an accounting problem.
Mm.
The accounting problem is the other side of the balance sheet is not there. So we're fixing it with that. And so you need to think about the way, I think you need to think about them differently, and I certainly think that you need to be clear on which is which.
But what's the consequence of thinking about them differently?
That for the mismatch, you almost need to, what it's doing is it's telling you information about something that's not there. Whereas on the bridging item, all the parts of the balance sheet are together. You never have to adjust your balance sheet again. It's got all the parts in it. But a mismatch is actually something, there's a missing element of information that you're looking for.
It's quick, we do feel that it maybe gave more transparency into OCI, so it'd be good to understand whether you think that sort of split between the two would actually provide you with useful information.
So consequence would be you'd classify it and show it under a different heading.
Maybe, possibly. Possibly.
Yeah.
Robert? I wanted to pull sort of the dot, line up the conceptual pieces. Peter said it very interestingly. He said realization valuation changes. And why that's so important is because we actually value them differently. The realization gets one type of multiple. The valuation changes gets a different type of multiple. And if you look at that division, if you look at that way, that methodology division, so think of a operating company that builds widgets and they made a bunch of money on their hedging activities, those get very different. And I think it even applies to a bank. They made business on their loan business, they've got a loan business, they've got a retail business, and they made some money on their trading activities, and we will value them differently. And if you start with that conceptual framework, you then realize, okay, well, realization matters, therefore everything gets recycled. That just falls out of that conclusion. And then the second thing comes out is this discussion about, okay, well, what about the other pieces that we don't know exactly where we're supposed to put? And you realize that bridging is different than the bridging between historical and fair value is one type of information, and maybe you just lump it in OCI, or maybe you do create a separate line, and as long as it's clear, geography doesn't matter, so as long as we know what it is. And so it becomes valuation of stuff that's sort of pull this quickly together, valuation of stuff that is so liquid that it was a decision this morning to sell it or not sell it probably should flow through the income statement. revaluation that is not really easy to sell the subsidiary in another country or a plant, probably revaluation through OCI, because it's really the revaluation. And then you have a couple of other lines. You have bridging, which you need to put because that's good information. And then finally, there's the plug number that just we've got part of it let's say we're using different fair value methodologies for assets and liabilities for whatever reason. There's a mislink, or one's historic and one's not, and there's a mislink. And if you think about it that way, as decision useful information, it all falls right out for you, and you answer some of the questions fairly easily.
Dennis.
Yeah. Robert's kind of taken my points. We share the point. So I agree with his point, whether you conceptually think that OCI is a kind of an accounting band-aid or it is a genuine component of the performance of a firm. So I think that's an important starting point. What is it for? Is it because we need a solution for the elements that you put on the slide, or is it because we have components of performance that need separate presentation? And then the question is, because we've come to the current items within OCI more by accident than by design, would we have started with a blank sheet of paper? Would we have included those items, or would we have included others? I throw on the table impairment of goodwill. So I think that's also kind of where you need to think about, is this now by accident we've got a list of items? Is that satisfactory? Are there other items we need to include if we're going to use it as a statement of performance type?
Saichi?
Thank you. I've been almost always a minority or lone wolf in this meeting, so it was my pleasure to find that I have basically the same opinion with Peter and Sue mentioned earlier. So I support to have the two numbers, performance numbers and the OCI numbers. And if we could define what assets and liabilities should be measured at fair value, then comprehensive income can be automatically determined. And therefore, the question is where are we going to divide in the middle, net income and OCI? I think the concept is the realization. What has been realized should be included in the net income. What has been the fluctuation of asset and liability values could fall in the OCI. In this way, I think we have two different characters, two numbers with different character. OCI, including everything, net income, backed by the realization and backed by cash. And this, of course, lead to the support of the full recycling. Now, as to the pension recycling discussed earlier, the ISP determined not to recycle pension OCIs because they cannot identify the trigger points. Now, I have the idea for the trigger point for pension recycling. That is a cash movement. When the pension is in surplus, sometimes corporation will withdraw pension money to the parent company. There's a cash outflow. Then this could be the trigger event to recycle the pension surplus. When the pension is in deficit, eventually a company has to pay more money to the pension, another cash flow. This is the trigger event to recycle the pension deficit. Thank you.
Saichi, can I just confirm something, just to go back half a step? Would you also take the profit and loss on trading income through OCI? So unrealized trading portfolios.
No, I don't think so. That's a separate matter. What I said is that basically the assets and liabilities remeasured should fall into the OCIs. Inventories and these things, I think, should be included in the operating income and expenses.
Thanks. Jed?
Well, I was just going to ask you exactly the same question. Just having the defining line between realized and unrealized is opening up for management to massive manipulation of, they'll sell a few things they've got some inherent gain in that's already at fair value on their balance sheet in order to deliver any profit number they want. I mean, that's quite scary.
That would probably be my concern as well.
I mean, there are clearly things. So, change in discount rate on long-term environmental obligations goes through financing instead of through OCI. You know, there's a lot of things that are inconsistent between that are economically similar in current accounting that we do need to get lined up.
Or at least think about. Work through once we understand what the conceptual framework is to see how those actually fit within it.
Yeah.
Peter?
Trading, true trading creates profits over time. But when we come to the 31st of December, the amount that is unrealized, if you have a fast-moving portfolio, should be very small. But the problem is that sometimes we call investment trading. So you have an investment gain that we classify as trading, and then it becomes problematic. So I think true trading is no problem, because the unrealized profit at the 31st of December, or whenever we like to measure it, is small, because the portfolio moves very fast.
Well, I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, we've got a lot of mutual fund holdings where, you know, the average stock holding will be 18 months, but there'll be some in there that you haven't traded that individual holding for 4 years because it's a solid business that continues to deliver returns, and there may be a massive inherent gain in there that you haven't actually realized.
To me, that is not trading. To me, that is investment.
And I think you're right.
Security for long-term gain.
So you'd carry it at cost from a P&L perspective. If you think about what's gone through the P&L, you wouldn't recognize any benefits from an investment portfolio until you actually sold them in P&L terms.
You mean in an industrial company?
So if it's an industrial company that happens to own, you know, a couple of hundred million invested in a range of listed entities that they've held for a long time, you'd basically just leave them, you'd just recognize their dividends through their P&L. And not think about any gains until they actually sold them, and then you'd allow them to take that the sale gain into P&L in the period in which they sold it in entirety.
Let me answer the following way: we have that situation on the Stockholm Exchange. Investment companies that are not revaluating but presenting information about their holdings, so you can do your own revaluation, and we have the other kind of company also, because they normally have quite a large portfolio of listed shares. And they are constantly criticized, whether they revalue themselves or if they just present the information. So I think if you have an investment in a security, you always have a problem. To me, that is not really the kind of company that I'm looking at, the investment companies or similar. But more the transaction-based companies. And that is the case I'm talking about. So I haven't a clear
It might be worth saying what we're talking about now is where we draw the line, as opposed to saying there should be a line.
Yeah.
So I think all of us are clearly saying that there are some businesses that it's correct to go through OCI, and there's some that's correct to go through profit and loss, that fair valuation. We just need to figure out exactly where that line goes. Tuck, did you want to come in?
Yes, exactly the same point that Darrell pointed out. I just want to test or listen to the views of users about the notion that the OCI is a bridging item of two measurement bases. I am a bit skeptical to this notion. This is not really answering to the question why we have two measurement bases. Why do we need to have two measurement bases, for example, in the IFRS 9? Without thinking about why we need to have two measurement bases, we cannot say this is just simply the bridging item. And then, to me, it is all about timing relevance. Profit or loss is, definition of profit or loss is clear. Change of asset or change of liability is income, and the change of liability is expense. And then the income minus expense is net profit. This is, in a sense, very clear. But our conceptual framework is not really answering what is the proper timing to recognize. And then If we could address what is the proper timing, what is the timing relevance, then we could, in a sense, define what should go through profit or loss, what should go to the OCI. Because our financial statement... Yeah.
Tuck, can I interrupt you for a second?
I just wanted to test, what do you think about timing relevance? I just want to listen to the user's view.
If you don't mind, what I'd like to do, just given that we've battled all day to keep in time, and I'd like to try and keep it to the surface.
Yeah, okay.
I think those are the questions that possibly we could think about picking up at the next meeting. Which is once we, if we have a fairly clear view here, which it seems to me we have, that there is a role for OCI to play, then what we can perhaps look to pick up as a second issue that we can prepare for at the next meeting is where do we think that role should be? Because I suspect if we get into that discussion, we might be here for a lot longer.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Yes, that's what I'm going to look forward to.
Absolutely. So we'll make sure you get. You're part of the agenda discussion later.
But what's the alternative? What's the alternative of not having...
Everything goes through profit and loss. Absolutely. So it sounds to me like we've got a fair amount of consensus here that there is a role for OCI to play, and that certainly as a characterization of the two places it plays in, the bridging and the mismatch are the two spaces it primarily plays in.
Well, you can... The alternative would be that you're just providing additional subtotals in your profit and loss, because the issue, and I think that was picking up on the point of what is profit, remember that when analysts and investors look at profit, they don't necessarily look at the IFRS bottom line earnings number, because they want a proxy for recurring profits from ongoing business. So there are, in the profit and loss statement, numerous items that analysts will label as one-off extraordinary items. So the question is, if you think about the role of OCI, perhaps OCI should be used for that purpose and say, well, everything, however difficult to operationalize that concept, but perhaps OCI has a role for fair value changes, non-recurring gains or losses. Which means you could also provide more subtotals to identify those different items.
Mary? Last point, I think. Well, okay, and then Peter, after you.
It's to kind of test your assertion of what I think. Here's the question that I think is the acid test of, do people believe that OCI has a purpose? And I'm not fighting against that, just to make sure we understand it is. If you think of the example of a bridging item, where you have generally current value on the balance sheet, and you are splitting the recognition of that change into maybe some piece that goes into P&L and some piece in OCI. That's really, I think, the one that tests the notion of, do we need an OCI? Because if you think of a single statement, presumably you'd be collapsing that change in measurement into a single line item. And, you can argue about whether net profit is a subtotal or a separate statement, but I think the question is there value in disaggregating some measurements, as well as separating off the things we've characterized as incomplete remeasurements? I think if you think about that disaggregation, that's really the test of, do you want it in two places versus do you want it in one?
I think that's perhaps more the question we have answered, is I think people feel they do see value in the two-spread places.
Very quickly, I think this is a review of conceptual framework. It would be really useful to have one paper that says, if OCI didn't exist, what would you do? And I think we'd get something much closer to what Dennis has just said, actually. And we did in the original FSP consultation.
And then I think I'm going to stop at there so we can move on to the next section. So, Amy?
Yeah. So this is Agenda Paper 4A, and it provides some feedback on the discussion forum survey that we recently posted and undertook. So the slides go through the purpose of the recent disclosure work, what we did, what we heard, and potential next steps. And I stress these are the potential next steps, because it's not what the ISB has decided, this is just what the staff thinks the ISB could consider, and we're in the early stages of the process. So we wanted to ask the CMAC questions about both what we've heard about the problem and about potential next steps. So, starting with the purpose of the work, which is on slide 3, we heard during the 2011 agenda consultation that many respondents think that a disclosure framework is needed to ensure that information disclosed is more relevant to investors and to reduce the burden on preparers. So in order to respond to that, the ISV decided to host a discussion forum on disclosures to get a clearer picture of what the disclosure problem is, its causes, and explore opportunities of how disclosures can be improved and simplified within the existing disclosure requirements. And the forum also aimed to foster dialogue between the various groups involved in the financial reporting process. So in conjunction with this, we launched a survey on disclosures in order to get a clearer picture of the problem and so on before the forum. We note on slide 4 that a number of other organisations have already started working on the topic of disclosures, and we've given some examples here, and there are other organisations. For example, the ANC has done some work on small listed companies. So we received approximately 225 responses to the survey, with about 50% being preparers, 20% being users, and 30% being others, which is auditors, regulators, industry organisations, etc. And we're very pleased with both the quantity and quality of the results we got back, and a number of people gave quite detailed answers to the survey. So the problems that we heard about, so slide 6, we've heard that there is a disclosure problem. In fact, over 80% of people thought there was a disclosure problem. However, it became clear that users and preparers viewed the problem differently. So preparers mainly focused on too much relevant information, i.e. disclosure overload. However, although users thought that this was a problem, they gave greater emphasis to poor communication and not enough relevant information in the annual report. There were similarities, though, with both preparers and users being concerned about the generic information, language used in the annual reports and the immaterial information that's included.
So, when you mean generic, you mean boilerplate. So it's a popular word for boilerplate.
So slide 7 moves on to talk about the discussion forum. And at the forum, we had over 120 attendees, with a further 29 ISV members or staff in attendance. We also had approximately 40 listeners to the morning webcast and 25 listeners to the afternoon webcast. And the next slides go through some of the problems that we heard about before. So, like with the survey, it wasn't clear that participants all agreed what the disclosure problem is. However, preparers and investors did seem to agree that financial reports are an important communication tool. We heard that investors want to hear the story of the entity and preparers want to tell that story. However, there are some barriers in achieving this. And although the objectives of the ISV, the auditors and regulators are appropriate, there's a perception that all of these parties contribute in some way to the financial reports being treated as a compliance document rather than a form of communication.
We might all go home if we think they're just compliance documents. We don't. We take them seriously. There's lots of useful information. I just get annoyed at the way that the preparers and lots of the people who are partly politically driven are coming from the point of view that financial reporting is broken. Now, we as users don't make the best use of the information, make mistakes. Obviously, you know, we'd like more of this, less of that. But the sort of idea that they're almost worthless because you can't see the wood for the trees, or they're just compliance driven and there's no obeying the spirit of the law, is just nonsense. It's, you know, there's lots of useful information. We just need to get on and use it. So,
Jane, one of the concerns with the compliance orientation, I think, is a preparer concern. But what happens is that preparers sometimes seem to spend as much time on the irrelevant stuff or the immaterial stuff as they do on the material or relevant stuff. And the result is that if there's a balance of resources out there, they're not spending enough time on the material.
That can't be true. It can't be true that they're spending as much time on irrelevant information as relevant information. They are spending most of their time on relevant information, you know, quite a lot of time finessing it. But they're spending a lot of time on it is because they know that we are very bothered about it and they're worried about how exactly how they present it. That's how it should be. It's a, this is not going to be a consensus. You know, we are coming at these things from different points of view. It's adversarial in some ways.
Absolutely. Is there irrelevant information on the financials you see?
There's unnecessary duplication. Sometimes there's too much detail. I think Sue's body, the financial report, is going to try and take a red pen to some stuff. I would be surprised if you could take a red pen to more than 10% of any set of annual reports. And most of them would be getting rid of duplication. Or, well, if it was more than 10%, it would be saying, this is boilerplate, same thing said every year, let's put it on the web. Which is not saying it's irrelevant, it's just saying there's a different place for it, but it's not been relevant in the last 12 months.
Martin?
Yeah, I almost am a bit ashamed to disclose what recently is one of my things I need to spend a lot of time on, and that is taking the red pen, in this case Stylus, and downloading the annual reports of Dutch listed companies and going through them and crossing out sections that are completely irrelevant. And there are a lot of those paragraphs, not entire sections, but paragraphs. And everyone knows the significant accounting policies paragraph is full of irrelevant information, and only a handful of companies really make that paragraph matter. And actually, some of that information is actually counterproductive for an analyst. If a company more or less copies what's written in IFRS, then I need to read it and think, would this be really a carbon copy of what is written in the book? Or did somehow the company tweak it a bit? And if it's not completely one-on-one, is it material? And how can I tell if it's material? So I think every instance where a company, without quoting, copies text from IFRS, it's for me a additional burden, because I don't know, it takes lots of time to assess whether it's a problem or not. So it's I do think there are very identifiable areas where there's disclosure and overload or misinformation or disinformation, I don't know what's the appropriate word, and there's low-hanging fruit here.
What are some other examples of, other than the significant accounting policy note?
Oh, that's writing style, where people put down a table and then start describing the numbers in the table. I can read. I mean, and you end up with reports of 260 pages.
And corporate governance stuff, quite a lot of that. But that's French style stuff, you know.
Yeah. Thank you. I think to answer your questions, yes, there is a disclosure problem. I think the concern I have is that certainly the ISB shouldn't be the only party that's dealing with it. Where you're talking about immaterial disclosure, I think the ISB should be more robust and say the standards are clear already that if something is immaterial, you don't need to action it. It's then up to enforcers and then preparers to deal with the problem. So I don't think the ISB should be trying to do things that it's already dealt with and is a failing of other parts of the reporting process, and I think that's really important. I think you've limited resources and it's wasting time in one sense. Where I think it can be helpful is in terms of disclosure overload or immaterial disclosures. I think the hesitation that I as a user have in deciding something is not important is because there's very dense narrative sometimes. I think the whole approach of disclosure perhaps needs to be looked at, and as S&P, we responded to the FASB disclosure discussion paper, and as part of that we gave some thought as to, you know, there is a lot of disclosure overload, but there's a lot of information that can be useful. I think what we need is more quantitative information in a standardized format, and we went back to the Financial Statement Presentation Project, which kind of proposed roll forwards and reconciliations. And that's a really good starting point, although it may increase volume, potentially increase volume. It's a good starting point for a user to be able to kind of scan more quickly the volume of information that's there and focus in on areas where they want some more qualitative analysis. So I don't think it's a pure question of volume. I think it's the type of volume that you need to think about as well. More quantitative disclosures to, and then more drill down of those quantifications, I think, would be a good starting point to help identify areas of greater interest where then the investors and the users can question management more directly.
Thank you. Robert?
Contrary to what your survey said, a lot of the objective of preparers is compliance, not communication. So that they certainly want to tell you the story when it's a good story, but when the standard requires them to comply to telling you about the bad story, they really want to tell you as little as you possibly can. So they want to communicate, but the act is in, if you read carefully, they only want to communicate the good stories. The low-hanging fruit is in two places. There is a lot of repetition between what we call in North America the MD&A and the financial statements, and that's outside of the purview of the Standards Board, but that you could hugely save information by somehow figuring out just to say it once. And there's some good financial reports where you see people feeling obligated to repeat the same table. And that's maddening, because then you have to read it with a fine-tooth comb to see whether they actually sold you something different. The other place is, and there's a simple definition of boilerplate. If you read the declaration and can't figure out which company it is, it's boilerplate. And there's a lot of this that you really have no idea what company it is, and there's nothing that's entity-specific.
Dennis, last one, and then I think we move on.
Yeah, basically echoing both Osman and Robert's comments on the materiality. We are not interested in knowing of Vodafone's 20 million defined benefit pension scheme. We don't need the detail. We know they've got DC. It doesn't matter. On Robert's point, I think I would also be interested to see if the board could develop a view on try to get the MD&A within the financial statements. If we're telling a story and we're telling a story, we're providing financial information, then there seems overlap. And if you try to integrate it, perhaps you can better check for the fact that if they tell a positive story, but you can see the numbers which actually contradict that positive tone, then I think they'll be helpful. So I think it's interesting to pursue whether there is a way to integrate the two. Now, on Martijn's point, I recently joined a university. There are certain software packages that can test for plagiarism, so if you would want that to test where the companies are typically copying the ISB, we can make that available to you.
Thank you.
So, moving on to the next steps, which is slide 14 onwards. And as I said earlier, the ISB hasn't decided on these. This is just what the staff is considering. And as has already been mentioned, we heard and the forum and the survey confirmed that this is a joint problem and it needs to be addressed by all parties in the financial reporting process. So in terms of what the ISB can potentially do, firstly, as I said, we've done preliminary analysis of the discussion forum and survey, and we're planning to publish a feedback statement shortly with a more in-depth analysis on these events. And we think that feedback statement can be useful for future outreach and to further foster views and disclosures, and also to make more parties aware of the disclosure problems that are faced. On slide 16, I think the ISB can consider how it can help in getting all parties to address the disclosure problem, either directly or as a facilitator, and the ISB will continue to work with users and preparers, for example, at the GPF and CMAC meetings. And they can consider what other work could be done. Slide 17, we think the ISB could consider some short-term amendments to IS1. For example, removing language which could imply preparers are constrained to particular presentation orders. Another example is an amendment to change language which could potentially be interpreted as restricting an entity's ability to use judgment when disclosing accounting policies and particular insignificant or boilerplate accounting policies. And lastly, we're looking into whether there is anything the ISB could do in respect of net debt and EBIT and EBITDA. We also think the ISB could consider doing some work on materiality. For example, it could look into perhaps application guidance or educational material. And as we've already discussed, there's the conceptual framework project, which will have the presentation and disclosure chapter. And we think there could potentially be a longer-term project in conjunction with this to review standards-level disclosures in the context of the new framework. So the questions which are laid out on slide 18, we just wanted to ask your views on these potential steps, what other steps you think there are, and what users can do with regards to the disclosure problem.
So saying that you're looking at doing something about EBIT and EBITDA?
Oh, sorry, this is in the short-term amendments slide. So there's the short-term amendments slide, we are thinking potentially something.
That we did not discuss at the board table, I think.
This is a new bombshell. This is a new thing that was brought, I think, to the advisory council by Alan Teixeira, basically saying there's a few things that should we be bringing these items to the board to discuss, because these are items that might be easily resolved and help out users.
Can you tell us more? What's the idea? To define EBITDA or EBIT? No, to do what?
I think it was more to acknowledge that it is used. And I think there was... it'd be good to get your views. This is things we are considering. We're in the initial stages, so we're trying to think what we could do to make
it. Christy, would that be by acknowledging the fact that those are measures that people use?
Yes.
We would make it very clear that people need to make sure the building blocks for those measures are included in the financial statements. So it kind of comes back to your return comments earlier. If there are particular building blocks or particular formulas used, should we be trying to define the building blocks?
Do we need to invent the wheel? Because, I mean, it's been used by everyone. Okay, common practice or operating income as well. So there are a couple of dozens of terms which are used currently. And the regulators, all of them have said when you use those terms, you must do this, this, and this. It must be consistent, it must be meaningful, it must be reconciled. It must be audited in certain cases. What else can we do?
I think the idea was to have the subtotals presented, but the subtotals based on IFRS numbers, and that way at least the subtotals were seen as coming from IFRS numbers. But we do need to discuss this with the board, so I don't think
it hasn't been
we want to.
Just a quick comment. We are perfectly capable of adding two numbers.
If we know what they are.
We may disagree about those two numbers.
We will disagree about the significance of the two numbers we added together, but we currently can do it. We work in a world where everything's on a spreadsheet. If you want to add another row, you just add it up. What is much more important is actually what Philippe was saying was about It's the making sure that that if you use a number that isn't, if you choose to throw in a subtotal, we really need to know where you got it from. And if you choose to use non-GAAP numbers, we have to have the reconciliation back to it. But if you really want to talk about EBITDA, I think the question is why is it used is an interesting question. Because there are people who say that it should never be used, and clearly it is used.
Which is almost certainly not our question to answer.
But...
Sue, did you...
Sorry, it's just a bit like the OCI discussion. We keep nibbling around the edges of the project that we really, you know, in response to the agenda consultation, we all said we wanted doing, which is financial statement presentation. So, you know, coming at it from the bottom by having a look at OCI, and you're coming at it from the disclosure will help us to sort out our spreadsheet of FSP. But the trouble is with that, you leave the fields to everybody doing their different thing, and, you know, I was looking at something yesterday and there was 20 things left out of their adjusted so-called profits. Do you want to leave the field completely to the preparers on this?
And this is, you're talking about the non-GAAP measures in that space?
Yeah, but by making them non-GAAP, you've left the field to a million different ways to do it.
Just quickly, I think bringing a bit more, just being a little bit more open to some of these non-GAAP, I think can be helpful. I think it probably relates to the point Dennis was making about sort of integrating financial review or MD&A sort of information with the financial statement information. That's currently quite difficult, although I know some companies are making some headway, and I think we'll see reports this year that have sort of the financial review MD&A bit, and there's the financial statement, and then you get the next one. I think we'll find more and more companies experimenting, and that's something that we're looking to possibly do some work on in the lab But I think being more open to the non-GAAP that are used and kind of help people to sort of relate them to the financial information that is GAAP and is required is going to be helpful at the end of the day. In the work the lab did on net debt, it wasn't felt necessary by the investors we talked to anyway to define net debt. But to relate it and to show the changes, and it's part of this nibbling away at the sort of presentation of cash flow statement. It all relates to this, but I think the more we can kind of bring this information together, it would be helpful for
users. And there you're talking about just making sure that people can understand how you got to those measures.
That's right. More than so anything you, else. You define net debt. What do you manage as net debt, essentially? And then relating the changes in the net debt figure to cash changes and the sort of variety of non-cash changes in the reported amounts.
Kid?
Actually, I was going to make two points. The first one, just very briefly on non-GAAP performance. Yeah. So I would quite like the ISB to come up with, through the financial statement presentation project, something that gets close to what most people economically agree is close to some measure of recurring or performance or whatever. Okay. I'm seeing far too great a proliferation of non-GAAP measures that include economically misleading data about the performance. So, for example, examples where people just put in, as the pension cost, the cash contribution. Well, if you've got an overfunded scheme and you put in zero, there's no charge for pensions, yet people have worked for that year and they've earned something. Adding back stock-based compensation, adding back all amortization of all intangibles, even ones that are clearly wasting assets, which are, you know, are going to need to be replaced. So stuff like that, I think, needs to be, you know, but you've created this vacuum by not having anything that's a measure of performance, so people can come up with any non-GAAP measure they want. And I think that should be pushed back on. In terms of sort of the work you're going to do around materiality and what further guidance you can give, I'd be very grateful if you could put as much emphasis on making sure material stuff that isn't disclosed is included as stuff that is immaterial that is disclosed should be removed. You know, pensions being a good example where you've got Vodafone with a small defined benefit scheme. We don't need sensitivity of the defined benefit obligation to changes in mortality, which will barely move it. But for example, you know, why did we end up in that position for pensions? We did, and the standards and the disclosure were written so we could see all the information we needed to for companies like British Telecom, where the defined benefit obligations are multiple of the market cap. And so people need to be able to step back from that. But there are businesses that people are in where there's material information that there aren't full standards that describe what's required. So for example, automotive leasing companies. So if you're a car OEM with a leasing subsidiary, you know, the sensitivity of your balance sheet to residual value movements is pretty large. So seeing some sensitivity table to the value of your residuals and what that might do to your balance sheet is as important as the pension sensitivity to mortality rate. Well, we get the sensitivity to mortality rate, we don't get that for others. It's clearly material, we don't get it. And the companies should be looking at ISO 1 and saying that's material information, we should disclose it, even if there's not a standard. But the pushback you get from companies and auditors is, well, there's not a standard that tells us we've got to do it, so we're not going to tell you.
Good comment. I've got Robert, Dennis, Cosma, and Martin, and I think we'll probably call it on this discussion. Robert.
I want to pull back a comment that Jane said, nibbling at the edges. Part of the problem is that we don't have a clear vision of what should be in the profit and loss. We don't have a clear vision of what was really supposed to be disclosing. And if we had that sort of vision, a lot of these things should fall out automatically. We're nibbling at the edge of OCI, but we don't really know why we're using OCI. We talk about EBITDA. We talk about what's not being disclosed. All of these things are systematic. A single problem is we just don't have...
Part of that is what the conceptual framework needs to be about.
Part of it is, but part of it is there's probably a standards level underneath that needs to be done too.
Now, very briefly on the next steps, is there a sense of urgency at the ISB that this is the disclosure issue is something that we need to address quickly? Because the steps seems to be kind of, okay, we view it as a problem, but is it an urgent issue? Kind of putting it up there as, do we believe it is an urgent issue that needs addressing?
I think the answer is yes, and that's why we've tried to, one of the reasons we had the forum, because we knew that there was, if we do anything at a standards level, and especially at the conceptual framework level, that is going to take a long time. So the forum was about trying to consider actions we could take within the existing framework, because that is going to be the quickest way we can deal with the problem. In terms of what we are in the next steps, I think the discussion that we're having around possible amendments to IS1, for example, that would be, we would try and do that as quickly as possible if the board agreed that that was something that we should do. I think the same with materiality. The other thing is we're hoping that this discussion forum starts the momentum, because I think we've got to get that momentum going to get it to be a more urgent project, or to get others brought in to get us to move forward. Is that...
Yeah, no, but it's kind of the nibbling at the edges. Is this enough? Kind of, is this enough to make us moving on the disclosure thing? That's kind of the concern I have. Is it enough to address some of the issues that we kind of agree are there?
I think there is a desire which is now being felt by preparers, auditors, and regulators to do something, and someone has to press a button to start it. Maybe just a small marginal amendment to IS1 could be the clear signal that will give a reason for people to change their behavior, maybe. It's my feeling that, for instance, ESMA is working hard on doing something, but they need someone to start it, and we may be the ones who start it.
I can't disagree with some of the items that have been brought up, like the importance of non-GAAP measures and the understandability and the reconciliation to IFRS, and the fact that there's some important elements that affect some companies where there's no accounting standard. I go back to the point that this is not currently the ISB's problem, and you really need to be, in my view, a lot more assertive about saying to enforcers and preparers, you've got the IS1, it says if something's immaterial, you don't need to disclose it. And then it says, once you've complied with everything, go back and see if there's any information missing that would, you know, impair giving you the users a true and fair view. What more do you need? If you were starting with a blank sheet of paper, that's a pretty damn good start to begin with. So it then becomes a problem of enforcement and the problem of the preparers not complying with the spirit of the standards. So I think just to finish the point, there's a lot to do in the area of disclosure. This is not the area that you should be focusing on. It should be about a wholesale look at the format of disclosure and that final, going back to that financial statement presentation project and saying, you know, here's the framework to provide the disclosures. It's not about non-GAAP and immaterial disclosures.
Martin?
First about the non-GAAP. I think I would want to give preparers a reasonable amount of freedom to define their own non-GAAP measures. If you look how many measures there are, I think it will be very difficult for the ISB to come up with a standard that for every business model, certain currently non-GAAP measures become GAAP. I mean, that's just not manageable. I think what you could say is that if a preparer comes up with a non-GAAP measure, that it at least applies that measure in a consistent way. So if it provides 2 years, the two calculations at least are on the same basis, identical basis.
Do you think that's for the ISB to do, or do you think that's for the regulator to do? Because the problem is, what we're trying to do is we're trying to regulate the stuff that you are not reporting.
We have already done loud and clear.
Yeah.
So I think it's...
I would be against prohibiting non-GAAP measures, because I think there are also a huge amount of users that know that the company has freedom to define it, and they may take more room than they should, but still want to know.
Okay. Perfect. Thanks very much. Insurance.
That's a great.
policy is something towards where matter of incentive scheme is constructing ways that they get drug companies who buy.
Okay, shall we go straight into this?
Drugs that are originally in the market.
You like it?